of righteousness until the last day. The topic of today's khutbah would generally be summed up as the avoidance of the forbidden. And the Imam began the khutbah by advising Muslims in general to turn back to Allah in repentance, to be aware of what they have done, which is in disobedience to Allah. Allah is the one who can forgive all sins if we turn back to Him in sincere repentance. And sins fundamentally represent the things which are displeasing to Allah, the things which Allah has warned us away from, either directly in the Quran or indirectly through His Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And it's very important for us to understand that what has been prohibited to us, whether it is something personal or something with regard to the society, that whatever has been prohibited for our benefit. Allah has not arbitrarily sought to make complications in our lives, whereby He has made a certain aspect of our lives difficult and He has made a certain aspect easy, in an arbitrary fashion. No. What has been prohibited, Allah is most wise. He knows the things which are harmful to us, whether on a physical level, whether on a family level, in a community, on a religious, spiritual level. He knows the things which are harmful to us. And as such, He has prohibited us from the various things which in one way or another will bring harm to us, whether physically or spiritually, socially or economically. However, harm, or wherever harm exists, we have been warned away from those things. As the Prophet Muhammad has said, that he did not leave anything which would take us away from Allah and send us to hell without warning us away from it. Everything which is harmful to us in any way, shape or form has been prohibited by Islam. The Prophet ﷺ made a general statement, لا ضرر ولا ضرار, that there should be, we should not do anything which is either harmful to Allah or harmful to others. These are general statements. There are specific statements the Prophet ﷺ has also given, and Allah has explained in the Quran specific statements which prohibit us from specific things. So we have two categories of prohibition: those things which are specified and those things which are included in general prohibition. What the Imam went on to point out today, using a particular tradition attributed to the Prophet Muhammad by way of the companion Abu Huraira, which is collected in a collection of hadith known as Sunan al-Tirmidhi. However, this particular hadith is one whose authenticity is in question due to some weakness in the chain of the narrator. However, as the Imam pointed out, there are other statements of the Prophet which are without a doubt accurate and which tend to strengthen this statement, to support it in spite of the weakness which exists in the chain of narrators. This particular tradition has in it a number of forbidden things which would become a part and parcel of the ummah, the practices of the ummah, at some point in the future, which would represent part of the signs of the destruction of the ummah and the coming of the last day. There were 15 different points which were mentioned. And as I said, all of them refer to various acts which in some way harm the Muslims, either as individuals, families, society, either economically or socially, either spiritually or physically. The first of those characteristics which would be a sign of the destruction of the Ummah was when the booty from the war is taken and given only to the rich. When Muslims are engaged in jihad, the properties which fall to them, Allah has stated in the Quran that these properties should be divided up amongst the needy, the poor, and the needy of the society, some set aside for Allah and the Messenger. However, one of the signs of the destruction of the Ummah, when the concept of jihad has been distorted, it no longer represents an effort to raise the banner of Allah, to establish the law of God on earth, but when it becomes one of what we could call imperialistic expansion, where a state is just expanding its borders to increase its power and to increase its wealth, when the jihad is distorted into such a state, and what is taken, what will happen is that what is taken in the course of that fight, which may be called jihad, and it will go to the rich and the powerful. Because the intent was wrong. The intent was not for Allah, that it will not reach the people whom it should reach. A classical example of that is the recent Gulf War. Saddam Hussein declared this to be a jihad. And the wealth which he plundered from Kuwait, this didn't go to the average person in the street. It went to those rich and the powerful who are around him. It went into their palaces or their whatever. Because that was not a jihad. Though he claimed it to be a jihad, it was just an imperialistic expansion. He wanted to gain control over the oil deposits that were in Kuwait. As simple as that. The second was that when a trust which is given is taken as a prize of war. A person gives you something to look after for them, and you look at that as something you've captured, like what you've captured in battle. It is not something that you look at as a responsibility, it's been given to you as a trust, a responsibility. No, you look at it as something which you are lucky to get your hands on, that you will use for your own personal aggrandizement. Or you will act with that which has been given to you in trust as if it were your own, spending from it freely. The example of this is like the wealth of Muslims you have in various societies, various countries. There is wealth there in this country. But the leadership takes this wealth. This wealth is in the hands of the leadership as a trust. Because wealth is a trust from Allah to man. And when we elect or we choose leaders amongst us, that wealth which belongs to us as a whole, which is in their hands for their administration for the benefit of the society, this is a trust which is given by the people to that leadership. Now when that leadership uses that freely, as if it were its own, the wealth which belongs to the people is regarded as being the wealth of those leaders, which they can give out as they please, to whom they please. They can spend from as they wish. This is one of those signs. And this is something which I'm sure you all, just reflecting on the various Muslim countries where Muslims are the majority around the world, so we see what is happening to the wealth of the Muslims, and how it is being utilized. Is it being utilized for the benefit of the society as a whole, benefit of the Muslims who are needy, you know, whether they're in that country or another country, or is it being used for the benefit of a particular ruling class, a set of people who are linked either by, you know, tribal relations, you know, or by political connections, or by whatever. This is the reality of our time. The first characteristic was when zakah is given as if it were a fine. When zakah is given as if it were a fine. The person doesn't give zakah because he believes this is a religious duty on his part. Allah has commanded him to give the zakah. So he does so to purify himself, to purify his wealth, to remove from his own heart that love of the material world, you know, that obsessive love of the material world. He doesn't do so because that. He's doing so because he is not a fine somebody has imposed on him. He must give. So what happens when he gives? He's not giving with a good heart. He's giving because there's pressure on him to give. And so he won't give as he should. He will find some kind of loophole, you know, either to give to people who shouldn't receive, like certain close relatives of his who are not eligible to receive from him, or he won't give the full amount that he should give. You know, because surely, if zakah were collected from the rich Muslim country and distributed around the Muslim world today, we would be hard pressed to find a poor Muslim anywhere. A Muslim who is starving to death, or, you know, I mean, not to say they'll be poor, because in any society they'll be rich and poor, it's because of the Yom Kiyam. But what I mean is poor to the point where they're starving to death, they do not have enough to feed themselves, you know. The type of situation that exists in the Muslim world today would not exist if zakah were properly paid by the wealthy Muslims of the Muslim world. When it was in the time of Omar and Abu Bakr and Uthman, when they sought to find people to give zakah to, they couldn't find people who could receive zakah, who were eligible to receive zakah. And the Muslim Ummah was not richer at that time than it is now. This is a reality. When zakah is paid as it should be, this provides a welfare, social welfare system which guarantees for the members of the community their basic needs. It's not going to necessarily make them richer, that's it. But everybody's going to become rich, too. Because they will always be rich and poor. They have to be for the qualities of generosity to develop. Because you cannot be generous unless there's somebody who is in need who you have to give to. You know, who has less of you, whom you can help. So, this is amongst those signs. And it is a sign, as I said, which is very prevalent today. The first sign was when people would seek the knowledge of the religion not for the sake of Allah. Not for the sake of the worship of Allah. They didn't go to seek knowledge. They are seeking that knowledge in order to gain position in the society, or to gain wealth, or either power, or economics, or as a point of pride, seeking it so they can have a certificate they'll put on their wall that says, you know, he is doctor, so and so. And this is something I know myself. I could see with my own eyes when I was studying in the Islamic University of Medina, where there are Muslims from all over the Muslim world studying this. And I remember very vividly in the first year when we sat exam for the Quran, the memorization of the Quran, they mixed fourth year students with first year students. It was a mixture. There would be the deaf who were raised, the one student from the fourth year, then one from the first, one from the fourth, one from the first ordinary. And I found the individual sitting in front of me. I was in the first year. From the fourth year, ready to graduate. This is the examination for the Quran, the memorization of the Quran. He is turning to the one who's behind me from the fourth year and asking him the answers. When the teacher, who is there, the examiner, when his back is turned or when he's checking some other students, this one is turning over, trying to talk to the one behind me. What's the answer? How does it first start? I said to him, brother, fear Allah. He says, many of you said. I said, you have to fear Allah, this is Quran. He said, mind your own business. And he was ready to fight me. Because I was trying to advise him, he should not be, because this is a man who is now ready to graduate. In the college of Dawah and Usul al-Din. Dawah, conveying Islam to others. What can this man convey? If he is prepared to cheat on his examination for the Quran, what can he convey to others? And beside me, with another individual who, from the fourth year, who I noticed also he had one little Quran, he was putting it out from his desk and looking at the verses and then writing it. And then I called the teacher. And so he hid it in his pocket that day. I called the teacher and said, this man isn't cheating. And the teacher came, he looked at the desk, he didn't see anything. Of course, he's not going to touch you. These were graduates from different Muslim countries, from here, from Egypt, from elsewhere, Pakistan. I'm not saying everybody was like that, but there were so many. And what even shocked me further, later when I was doing my examination in logic, they call mantiq, a very difficult subject in Arabic, especially. After we had studied all year, and the teacher, our professor, was giving us advice, how to prepare ourselves for the examination and, what to do and such and such. After giving the different points, he said, if your brother in the examination gets stuck, help him. I said, what do you mean by this? He said, your good friend, if he gets stuck, if he's stuck for an answer, it should help him. I said, how is this? Isn't this cheating? He said, no. Because when you study hard, you may, just when you go to examination, you get a mental block, you forget the answer. But you already studied and you know it. It should help him. Astaghfirullah. Here was the teacher himself, the professor himself, advising the students to help each other. This is the Islamic University of Medina, in the College of Dawah. So when we meet a state like this, and as I said, this is not to say that is the situation of the whole university, all teachers would do this, no. Nor am I saying that all the students were involved in this, no. But there are enough to make one wonder. And sitting with these students and talking with them, I found that many of them, if not the majority amongst them, did not come seeking the knowledge for the pleasure of Allah. They came because this was a need in their society to become, in a position of authority, a position of to be recognized, a person who is depended upon, is guaranteed certain monies, or whatever. They were coming for other intentions other than the pleasure of Allah. And this is why they could cheat on the Quran. In an examination of the Quran, because their intention was not pure, it wasn't for Allah. And this is not unique to the Islamic University. I remember reading last year, they had riots in Dhaka, Bangladesh, Muslim country.
students were rioting for the right to cheat on their examination.
Muslim students were rioting because the administration was trying to stop them from cheating, you know, setting up different systems which would prevent them from cheating altogether. And their students rioted for the right to be able to cheat on their exam. Our brother was adding that students who have tried to cheat on their exams were sentenced to 10 years in jail. But the point is, whatever the result, I mean, this is showing a mentality. It is showing a case where people are seeking knowledge, not for the pleasure of Allah. And of course, primarily, as the example I gave, the gravest danger is that of Islamic knowledge. However, all knowledge which is sought as a Muslim, whether we are seeking to become a carpenter or a barber or a truck driver or whatever, whatever knowledge that we seek, it should be for the pleasure of Allah. That however we utilize the skills which Allah has blessed us with, it is for the pleasure of Allah, in the sense that we do whatever we do in a way which is pleasing to Allah. This is what it means. Doing it for the pleasure of Allah means we're doing it in a way which is pleasing to Allah. You are driving a truck, it means you don't do anything in the course of your driving that truck which is displeasing to Allah. When you do it that way, that act that you're doing, the driving of a truck, becomes an act of worship of Allah. That is the way Muslim lives his life. Utilizes the knowledge which Allah has given him, the skills which Allah has given him or her. The fifth and sixth point was when a man obeys his wife and mistreats his mother. When a man obeys his wife and mistreats his mother. The example he gave was like when a wife asked him to do something, he quickly goes. However, when his mother asked him to do something, it's a burden, you know, I haven't got time, I'm too busy or whatever. It's not to say if his wife asked him to do something, he shouldn't do it. But that he should not be so anxious to do whatever his wife asks and be so, you know, to mistreat his mother in such a fashion. To not be anxious to suffer. Because we know that, you know, the Prophet ﷺ, you know, emphasized to us that the parents have rights over us. We have a duty to them, to serve them. They looked after us when we were young. We have a duty to look after them when they are old. And of course, this concept of obeying one's wife, this can also go into other areas. The areas where, you know, with women's liberation, you know, this movement which has come out of the West, where the women now are put in a position where they are equal to men, in the sense that, you know, they are equal partners, you know, they have just as much say as a man does. And so now you find women who will be commanding the men, who will become the heads of the family. The men are just doing whatever the women want them to do. This kind of a situation, this is what Prophet warned us on the signs of destruction, you know, that a people would not succeed who makes the woman their leader. This is a sign of the emasculation of the man. It's not to say that a man, you know, he has to be, you know, what we call in the West macho, you know, he's got to be in a, you know, he has to, everything is his wife wants, he has to put her down because he has to show he's a man. No, this is nonsense. But authority is supposed to be in his hands. So you find, for example, situations where there are women in the society who need to be married for one reason or another. Whether they're divorced, husbands are killed in war or in accidents, whatever. The women who are growing up didn't get a chance to get married because they were involved in studies or whatever, and they're now, you know, in latter parts of their life, difficult to get married, and the only option left for these women is polygamy. That another man will marry her who is already married to somebody else. But his wife tells him, no way! She may have him signed in the marriage contract that he's not going to marry anybody else. Here now she starts to dictate to him, he cannot. He will concede. He thinks about the idea, but he just has to put it out of his mind because he knows that his wife will find out that he was even thinking about it, he'll be in big trouble. This is a situation now where the men have become subservient to the women. What they may know to be right and correct Islamically, this needs to be done, etc. They can't do it for fear of the anger of their wife. This is an example. And of course, mistreatment of mothers, it can go beyond simply just not looking after or looking after whatever the mother asks. It could be putting women in old folks' homes, for example, like which is very common in the West. A woman, when the mother reaches a certain age, you know, then the children, they put her in an old folks' home. It is mistreatment of the mother. You know, mother, she gets old, she has to look after her. The elder son, it is his responsibility to take her in, or whoever amongst the family is able, they take her in to look after her. The seventh and eighth point was when a man shares his secrets, his thoughts, his friendship with his close friends and ignores his father. He won't sit with his father, discuss his problems and you know, what's on his mind, what his goals are, what his thoughts are, so on. So he doesn't do this with his father. But he does it with his close friends. In other words, the father, no value is given to the father. The father is just looked at as, you know, he's cast aside. Maybe he's put in an old person's home. Or he's just ignored. Any kind of advice he has to give has no meaning, no value. You know, this kind of attitude towards the elders, this is a thing which is despised in Islam. Islam has always held up the elders, you know, put them on a very, you know, high stature. Whereas we are obliged to seek advice from them to benefit from their experiences, from their knowledge, and especially our own parents. And this is very, very vital because when you are not able to communicate with your father, what you're looking at is the breakdown of the family. He is not able to convey to you the knowledge, the experience of his life, so that you can benefit from it and help your own children. So you are doomed then to repeat his mistakes. It is the breakdown of the family. And your children will continue that breakdown. They will find that they are rejecting you, even whilst you're still relatively young. You're not an old man anymore, but you try to talk to your child and he's just, you know, up in your face and, you know, who are you, you know? I can do what I want, this type of attitude. And it doesn't get better. It gets worse. So much so that you have, for example, like in the West, where parents, virtually, they're not allowed to hit their children. In the West, in America, if you hit your child with anything beyond your hand, or if you hit your child with your hand and it leaves a mark on that child, you can be put in jail. You can be put in jail for child abuse. So, of course, what does that do? When the child knows, you know, he's taught that in school, he sees it on television, means that if daddy hits me, he's going to be in big trouble, you know? So this is the attitude, you know, you better not hit me, otherwise I'm going to call 911 or, you know, whatever. So the, you know, parents are sort of put in a position, you know, like a position of extreme weakness. Because we know, of course, Islam does not encourage abuse. You know, just striking and hitting people for no reason or cause. But the Prophet Muhammad did say, teach your children the salah when they're 7, and hit them for it when they're 10. Hit them. If they're not, you know, going to the prayer session, we're allowed to hit them. And if we're allowed to hit them for salah,
you know, and the other things which are, you know, going to school or studies or whatever is even more so.
So, but of course, I said, you know, this is with certain, within certain reasons. So you're not just a striking out in a way to cause blood to flow, or, you know, these type of blows, hitting, striking, punching. This, no, of course, it's nothing like this. But a hitting in a way wherein some pain is inflicted, because this is the purpose of hitting, you know, and at the same time, the person is aware of why they're being hit. If they're at an age where they can be given, you know, a reasonable explanation, you have some kids of some age, you just can't give them a reasonable explanation. There's a kid who's 2 years old, he wants to stick his finger in the socket, you know, the plug, or the electrical socket. I mean, he's not going to be able to express it, if you put it in electricity, once your body might kill you. He doesn't understand it, he just wants to put his finger in. So you have, the only thing you can do is let him know that if he puts it in, he gets hit. If I see you trying to put your finger in there, you're going to get a hit. He can relate to that, he can understand that pain, you know, he does it. So he doesn't do it for fear of the pain. Because he's at that age when you can't explain to him. You know? And some people, in order to try to protect the children, what they do is they just try to block off all the sockets. They feel better than him, let me just block off all the sockets. But no. Because if you just block off all the sockets, it means you may go to visit somebody's house and he finds an empty socket and he goes to the door and everybody's blocking off the socket. So he has to be taught in his own world that this is wrong. You don't do it. So that wherever he goes, he is reminded of it. You know? I would say, you know, of course, we have to realize this, you know, and although in the modern theory of child rearing, they try to emphasize this, you know, treating children as little adults, so you reason with them, you know, use other methods other than hitting them. So this approach, which was proposed, you know, in the 50s by Dr. Spock and others, he's one of the leading proponents of it, and this is not Dr. Spock from the Enterprise project. But you know, this is an individual who was a medical doctor in the 50s who came to the forefront, you know, and became quite famous for proposing these various ideas for child rearing, which involved, you know, not hitting kids. And this is what has led to this situation in the school, for example, in America, where the teachers are not allowed to hit the children, the children, even the principal, nobody is allowed to hit the children. You know, where you find a situation now in schools where, you know, the teachers can hardly control the children at all. Children are bringing weapons to school and killing the teachers. You know, because he didn't like the mark the guy gave him on the exam, he pulled out a 45 and takes out the teacher. And this is happening, and we're joking and laughing about it, but it's real. It has happened every year, it's happening. And it's not getting less. Sign number 9 was when voices become loud in the masjid. When a masjid becomes like a marketplace, people are bringing in goods to sell, they're, you know, trading and buying and selling inside the masjid, which is prohibited in Islam. Someone said, if you see somebody buying and selling in the masjid, ask Allah to curse that sale. This is what they're supposed to do. You see somebody who's got goods to sell in the masjid, they're collecting money and selling it, and you say, Allah, please curse that sale. Because this is not what the masjid is for. The masjid is not for buying and selling. And of course, you know, the raising of voices is involved, whether it is whilst the khutbah is going on, people are chatting and talking, or whilst, you know, Islamic talks are being given, instead of people listening and benefiting from the talk, people will have side conversations going on where their voices become so loud that the other people can't even hear the talk which is going on inside the masjid. Or it may reach a stage where, you know, people are actually shouting and fighting in the masjid. And this is something which has happened in various masjids I know, in various places in the world, you know, where people have gotten up and, you know, gotten into actual physical fights in masjids, raising voices and actually hitting. The tenth was when a tribe of people are led by the most sinful amongst them, when the tribe chooses as its leader the most sinful, instead of choosing one who is the most virtuous, God-fearing, etc., to lead them, they choose the one who is the most sinful. Either because they themselves are sinful, and sin has become a virtue, or because they fear that individual, he is powerful, and because of the military or whatever power that is behind him, they choose him for fear of his honor. So they choose him, though he is the most sinful amongst them. And this, we have plenty of examples historically, you know, of leaders over Muslim countries, you know, who are involved prior to their leadership or even during their leadership in the most sinful of acts. The 11th point, very similar to it, is when the leader of the people is the worst amongst them, sort of further emphasis in the same concept. It goes beyond the tribes of the people in general. And in a sense, you know, as it's been said, you know, people are led by what they deserve. You know, when we look around the Muslim world and we see the state of its leadership, this is a reflection of the state of the Islam of the people as a whole. Sure, we can point our fingers to the leaders and say, oh, listen, this person is corrupt, or this one is this, or this one is that, or whatever. But that person is in that position because of deficiencies in the Ummah itself. They are the ones who, due to their lack of practice of Islam, their deviation from the teachings of Islam, have allowed such a leadership to arise amongst them. So they are held responsible of Allah will hold that leader, that corrupt leader, responsible. He will have to answer the day of judgment. But the people will also have to answer for allowing that man to be amongst them. So the blame is also on the people. Because ultimately it is the people who determine their leadership. It is ultimately the people who determine their leadership. The 12th point is when a man is treated nicely, he is given all of the amenities, you know, kindness, service, etc., for fear of his harm. You know, in Islam, Prophet has said that one who fears Allah on the last day should be kind to his guests. This concept of karam, or kindness, in Islam, it was elevated to a status of an act of worship, a part of faith. To be kind to guests. If a person comes to your home, you treat them kindly. You're eating a meal, you enjoy them, you encourage them to take part in your meal, or you bring them something to eat or to drink or whatever. It is a part of the characteristics of a Muslim. But at the same time, the Prophet has said that we should not allow anyone to share our meal with corrupt. You know, somebody who is a corrupt individual, we should not share our meal with such a person. We don't eat at their table, nor do we have them eating at our table. The basic principle in Islam that the corrupt should be pushed aside. You know, society should not treat them nice and kindly, because this is only encouragement to them in their corruption. It doesn't mean you don't give them dawah. Of course you give them dawah, but you don't bring them into your home, you know, and share your meal, because it corrupts your meal. It takes Allah's barakah away from it. So you give them dawah in other ways. But when a circumstance arises, when such a person comes to your house, because of the power that he has behind him, he can harm you. You are obliged to bring him in and smile and treat him nicely, feed his food, etc. You know, for fear of the harm that he can do to you. And this is the state around the Muslim world today. The 13th point is when there appears amongst the Ummah singing women and musical instruments. And the Imam went into this in depth. Singing women meaning women who are, you know, performers, right? As we know them now today, performing on stage for men, etc., singing in the musical instruments, the guitar and saxophone and all these various musical instruments. When this appears amongst the people, it becomes a standard, you know, as it has today, where music is in the home, in the car, in the store, the workplace, wherever you go, you know, there is music. This is a situation that has been described, where it has become such a part of the society that people cannot conceive of a society without it. People become so attached to it, they become addicted to it. And Islam hates any addiction except to the remembrance of Allah. It's the purpose of our creation is to worship Allah. So that is the only valid area that we should be addicted. We should be addicted to the worship of Allah. If we find ourselves not worshiping Allah, we feel something is wrong. We feel, you know, like we're going to withdraw. You know, we need to get to the masses. We need to do some righteous acts. We should feel that way. This is right. For the service of Allah, because that's why we were created. But for anything else in this life, to become addicted to it, it's prohibited. Whether it's physical or it is mental. Because when we're addicted to anything else in this material world, then in fact what has happened to us is that we are being drawn away from the remembrance of Allah. We seek refuge in other than Allah. So when we feel down, instead of turning back to Allah, making prayer, you know, turning to Allah, asking Him to give us strength, etc., depending on Him to raise our spirit, to give us the drive, we turn on the radio, we find a tape, you know, one tape that we like, and we listen to a bit and feel up again, feeling nice. You know, so this is a problem, isn't it? This is what music has become. It's a source of solace for people when they should be seeking solace in Allah. When Allah is the one who should be, by the contact with Allah, is the one who brings them back and strengthens them, they're doing it through the music. So the music, they are addicted to it. It becomes the thing with which they put their trust, their hope. It's there in the music instead of being in Allah. And this is why it is prohibited in Islam. Because music is a very powerful tool of Satan to turn people away from the remembrance of Allah. And the Imam, just to emphasize the significance of this issue concerning music, dangers of it, he quoted another hadith, Sayyidina al-Baqarah, which can be found in Sahih Bukhari. And so people might not think, well, okay, this is this hadith we talked about, there was something in its chain of narration, so maybe it's not so authentic or whatever. No. There is in Sahih Bukhari, in the chapter concerning drink, the hadith in which Baqarah said that one of the signs of the last day was when people would make allowable, permissible, zina, that is fornication and adultery, silk for men, musical instruments, and the drinking of alcohol. Calling these things by other than their name. Calling it by another name to give it some other impression to the people. This is not what is being done, but in fact, it is what is being done. So, by linking the musical instruments, use of music, Western or Eastern, modern music that we know of, this has been linked with fornication and adultery, the drinking of alcohol. So it is something very severe. Point number 14 that the Prophet was supposed to refer to as one of the signs was when the drinking of alcohol would become common. And this, of course, does not refer to what we may call the non-alcoholic beer, because some people mistakenly have thought, well, this non-alcoholic beer, this is drinking now. People are making this alcohol acceptable by calling it non-alcoholic. You know, but in fact, it's still beer, you know, or maybe wine or whatever, but they're calling it non-alcoholic. So in fact, we should be clear on this, that any drink which is not of itself intoxicating, no matter how much you drink it, it is not considered to be of the intoxicating drinks which are prohibited. Because in the Prophet's time, they had a form of drink which is called labiz, which is a fermented drink, but it was not alcoholic. There was a form which became alcoholic. He allowed them to drink that which was not alcoholic and prohibited that which was alcoholic, meaning that which was intoxicating. Because if anything ferments, there is a portion of alcohol produced. That process of fermentation is the process of formation of alcohol. You may find, you know, with modern instruments, a percentage of alcohol in yogurt. The yogurt which is on the market, you're eating it because it has gone through a process. And you will find, you know, maybe 0.0000001%. But that does not make it an intoxicating substance. Because no matter how much yogurt you eat, you're not going to get high. You're not going to get intoxicated. So therefore, the fact that there, you know, due to the powerful instruments that we have today to detect what is chemically identified as alcohol, this does not automatically put the judgment on that thing as being alcohol or intoxicating. We have to be clear on that. Intoxicating drinks which are prohibited or substances are those substances which, if you take them in large amounts, they will intoxicate you. Though if you take them in small amounts, they may not. This is the general principle which Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam gave. Whatever will intoxicate you, make you drunk, make you high, whatever, this is prohibited. Whether it is in small amounts or large amounts. But any substance which may contain chemically some of the properties which are essential in the alcoholic or intoxicating substances, substance is not automatically considered intoxicating and thus prohibited, unless it may intoxicate you in large amounts. So what this is more referring to, you know, is a situation where we find ourselves taking different substances which are being included now into medicines, etc. You know, different like thallium, etc. Different substances which are in fact intoxicating substances, which people may use the excuse that it is medicine to treat yourself with. But the Prophet has stated that Allah has not created a cure in the things which He has prohibited. That we should not treat our sicknesses, but we should not treat ourselves with those things which are prohibited, with the intoxicating substance. It should not be a part of our method of treatment. There may come circumstances, of course, you know, of absolute necessity, where life is threatened, where doctors may be obliged to use such substances, but not on the scale that it's being used today,
Well, we just find medicines all over the place which are, you know, of intoxicating taste. And when you take it, you become intoxicated. Right? And it is accessible to the masses of people. The 15th point was when the latter generations of Muslims would curse the early generation. Cursing them meaning not necessarily that they would say that they were disbelievers or, you know, call them sinners or whatever, which is what, for example, the Shiites, the main branch of the Shiites, say for example of Iran, etc., they cursed the early generations of Muslims. They cursed Abu Bakr, Omar, Uthman, they cursed them, the majority of the Sahaba, they cursed them, they consider them to be apostates. This is one form. But another way that it may be is by us saying, for example, that what that early generation did with Islam, this was suitable for their time. But it's not suitable for our time. You know, we need a new Islam. This kind of this attitude for Islam, which was understood and practiced by the early generations of Muslims, is not considered suitable for these modern times, for the 20th century. Because, so, under doing that, what happens then is that certain practices become allowable. Like dealing in interest, for example, where people you will see in Yusuf Ali's commentary, where he explained in the Surah Al-Baqarah, where he's talking about the prohibition of interest, where he said that he didn't believe that what the Prophet Muhammad was prohibiting was the modern banking institutions which are understood today. No, he was prohibiting only a certain form which is no longer, you know, present today in the various monetary transactions. So in doing so, he was making allowable, by his own personal opinion, he was making allowable something which was prohibited. And this is the argument used by most of the secular systems that rule the Muslim world today. When you listen to the arguments of the different rulers, why they don't want Islam to become the law of the land? Because it's not suitable. It's not suitable to these times. This is the basic argument. And of course, you know, the leadership coming out of America is the one telling them, yes, of course, it's not suitable. It's not suitable to these times. And they're just echoing these thoughts. So by doing that, by looking at Islam as not being suitable to these times, they're in fact cursing that early generation. Because Prophet Muhammad has said that you should, we are supposed to, if we want to be correctly guided, we should hold on to his sunnah. And the sunnah or the way of that early generation of Muslims, led by what is called the righteous caliph. And he also said that the best of generations is my generation. Then those who come after them, then those who come after them. Telling us that Islam as practiced by those early generations is the best way. It's the model for us. We should take from them and benefit. So when we say it is not the best way, in fact it's not relevant to us today, we are, in a sense, cursing that early generation. Then the Imam closed off the first part of the khutbah by quoting a verse from the Quran, which, in which Allah said, we should fear a trial which will not affect all you the sinful amongst you. And know that Allah is severe in retribution. اتقوا فتنة لا تصيبن الذين ظلموا منكم خاصة. It's a warning to us that it's not enough that we do right to be safe from the punishment of Allah. And if we allow those who are sinful to carry on with their sins, then Allah will send a punishment on us
which will not just hit those who are sinful, it will hit the society as a whole and include everybody. So it is our duty. It's the duty of the Ummah to make itself right, beginning with the base and ending with the leadership. It is the duty of the Ummah to establish correct leadership and to establish Islam within its members. In the second part of the khutbah, the Imam then went on to mention part of that punishment which the Prophet ﷺ predicted would overtake the people wherein these 15 characteristics had become common amongst them, where a red wind would come and destroy the people, earthquakes would be constantly afflicting them, and a portion of them would be transmuted into apes and pigs. And stones from the sky would rain on them, like what happened to the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. So these would be part of the trials and afflictions which would strike such people, wherein these various forms of disobedience had become a basic characteristic of the people. And of course, as he pointed out, when the Prophet warns us, tells us of the future, talking about these characteristics, it's a warning to us to try to do something about it, to try to change what we can while we can. It's also, whenever the Prophet speaks about a negative characteristic, untrustworthiness, he's also reminding us of its opposite, trustworthiness. So whilst we strive to remove these qualities of untrustworthiness, very sinful qualities, we strive to do so by developing their opposite. To be trustworthy, this is a characteristic which Muslims should hold. To give zakat from our heart as an act of worship, seeking the pleasure of Allah, etc. So we should take from these warnings not only the dangers of these sinful acts, but a call to their opposite, to various acts of righteousness. And that basically summarizes the khutbah, wherein the Imam reminded us to avoid those things which have been prohibited by Allah and His Messenger, because these things are harmful to us, fundamentally. Not to avoid them ritualistically, we just don't do it because it is part of the ritual of Islam. So you find somebody will say, or I've met people like this, will say, in America they've come over, they won't eat pork, but they'll drink alcohol. You suggest them to eat pork, he's very upset, but he's got a glass of alcohol in the table. And because it's a ritual. I met people who told me, one brother from Morocco, he told me that there, he and, I say a group of people, I can't say this is the case of every Moroccan, I doubt it, but there, back in Morocco, they used to break their fast with marijuana. The fast is just a ritual. Islam, whenever it becomes ritualistic in its practice, whether in the things that we do or the things that we don't do, then we have lost sight of the purpose. We are not capable of benefiting from the spirit, from the goal of the various acts of worship and
the goal of the various prohibited areas. We're not able to benefit from them because we're dealing with them in a ritualistic fashion. We should always understand that whatever has been commanded of us, it is for our benefit. Whatever has been prohibited of us, it is for our benefit. And we should always approach what we do and what we don't do in this fashion, so that it becomes a source of enlightenment for us. It raises us spiritually, brings us closer to Allah, and increases us in righteousness. If there is anything anybody would like to add or comment on or raise questions about now, inshallah, we'll go into our section of questioning. Comments. Okay, if nobody wants to think about something to say or whatever, I'll mention some points which have been raised to me. Which should be reflected upon. Those brothers, for example, who have come here with their wives and they have small children, you know, who are so small that, you know, it's not possible to keep them quiet, you know, in the course of, you know, such a long period of time, that to leave those children, for example, amongst the women who, you know, are in a very small and confined area where they're listening to the khutbah, etc., you know, when the children start to make noise, it's very difficult because they can't take the children out onto the streets or whatever, you know, that the noise sometimes can become very disturbing, so much so that the people, women who are trying to listen to the presentation or the khutbah, you know, they're not able to hear it properly. So I would advise, you know, the brothers, it's better if these very small children know that they should take them themselves, you know, when the time for the presentation comes or whatever, you know, after the khutbah, because up here, if a man, the child starts to make noise, he can step outside to avoid disturbance of everybody else, you know, much more easily than the women can. Anybody have any questions or comments? Okay, then.
As-salamu alaykum.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah.
I just could not talk by my brother here about the question. In classes, they heard about music, Quran, while in some places, they used to hear music in television, radio. You cannot see about that.
Well, you know, as we have pointed out, you know, on numerous occasions, we do not determine what is acceptable Islamically and what is not acceptable by what we find in the society. You know, what is acceptable and what is not acceptable is not determined by what we find in the society, because people can disobey Allah. So we can find things in the society which are prohibited. So we don't use a particular society or circumstance to justify a particular thing. For example, somebody may say, well, you know, when I went to Mecca, I found people smoking there. So how can you say that they're selling cigarettes in the stores? Well, how can you say that it is prohibited in Islam to smoke cigarettes when they're selling it in Mecca? So you see, the point is that the fact that it is sold in Mecca does not make it allowable. If the leading scholars, for example, of Saudi Arabia, quite openly have stated and written, you know, extensive booklets, etc., you know, explaining the prohibition of cigarettes, use of smoking, etc., we have to go according to what the Prophet Muhammad said, what Allah said. This is the basis of what is right and what is wrong. Not what people do. So if we find music on television, we say, and we try to come on to some of the prohibitions, we say that the television is not functioning according to Islam. That's what we say. We don't say that there must be something wrong with what the Prophet said, because it's on television. No. There must be something wrong with the way that the television is being used. Or the radio, or the media, or whatever. This is how when we use the Quran and the Sunnah as our guideline to judge the society, to judge the people, to judge the practices. We don't use the society to judge Islam, what is right or wrong.
Predictive science.
The predictive science?
It's Muslims and non-Muslims.
You know, but particularly Muslims. See, because many of these things are things which are common to non-Muslim societies. Many of these things are common to non-Muslim societies. So when it becomes really something serious is when it becomes common to the Muslim society. So I think primarily the Prophet is speaking about that situation amongst Muslims. But when it reaches that situation amongst Muslims, you can be sure that it reached that way amongst non-Muslims long before.
Excuse me, what is this red wind in Muslim
time? The red wind, which the Prophet spoke of, is the exact meaning of it, Allah knows. Prophet told us that a wind would come, and there are a number of other hadiths which refer to this wind coming, you know, which is like, be like a storm, and it was described as being red. It could be because the sand or the dust which is caught up in it is of a red color for one reason or another, you know, or a lot of what it could be. All we know is that this is how it has been described. When we see it, we'll know it. Another point which was raised was the concerning the head covering for women, the dress code. In particular, the scarf, known as the khimar, says this should be worn at all times when a woman is in the presence of people who are not her direct relatives, father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, you know, those whom she cannot marry. Outside of that, if she, at her workplace or elsewhere, is in contact with males, in particular, she should wear her head covering. This is something which was raised because of a misunderstanding on the part of some people, wherein the wearing of the head covering is like a costume, or the Islamic dress is like a costume. People put it on when the time for prayer comes. This is something which I observed at one time when I lived in Malaysia, that people, but they did there, in Indonesia also, it's quite common, that the women will carry a bag with them. Normally when they walk around the society, they wear skirts which are short and tight, and their hair is out and everything. But when they go to pray, they will carry a bag with this Islamic dress, which they, when they get inside the door of the mosque, they put it on, where you can see nothing but their face. It goes right down, covers everything. So they put it on when they're inside the masjid, when they're coming out, they fold it back up again, put it in the bag, and they step back home. So, it's as if they were made Allah in the masjid, but you know, Allah is not outside the masjid, so they know they have to go about the society, etc. And this is not the way Islam is. The system of dress, there is a purpose behind it. It was not only that they're taking it as a ritual, as I said, the costume, as the, you know, the way people dress up for Halloween, you know, you know, people are fasting, so they put on certain occasions, right? Easter Bunny, whatever, Easter come. But people are wearing these kind of costumes for these ritualistic purposes. For Islam, for Muslims to take the dress of Islam in that fashion, this is to deviate, to misunderstand the goal. Because the goal of a Muslim woman's dress is to maintain her modesty, to protect her from the harm of the society, particularly the males in the society. Because the more a woman is exposed, the more she exposes herself, the more she becomes subject to harassment by the males of the society. No matter what society, whether it's a Muslim society or a non-Muslim society. And I know some people say, well, you know, in Saudi Arabia where these people are covered up all the time, you know, of course there where a woman exposes herself, they'll go crazy. But in our country, you know, everybody's exposed. So the men, they're not that, you know, crazy as the Arabians, you know, the Arabs. But no, it's not the case. We look in the West, particularly in America, we know that the number of reported rapes last year was over 100,000, and it's increasing. This is a society where you're free to do anything. You can purchase prostitutes, anything, it's all over. But yet, so many women are being raped, and it's more and more and more. Harassed in the job. You know, when women are getting, you know, equal rights, as they call it, you know, being able to join the army and the navy and the everything. But when they're driving these places, they're getting harassed. The men are attacking them left and right. And this is directly related to the dress of the American or the Western woman. If you go back 70 years, if you look at the costume that the women used to wear when they went swimming, it's like a dress. Today, you can hardly see it. And we see a direct relationship. So, that dress of the Muslim woman is for her protection, to maintain her modesty. She covers her hair because the hair is a sign of beauty. Women are told that their hair is their crowning glory. You know how much money is spent in beauty salons to put their hair this way, that way, and the other way? I mean, why? Because what purpose? For the attraction. This is what it is about. So, women are enjoying to cover themselves for their own protection and for the protection for society. Not to say that the men are weak, but and that, you know, some people say, well, it's really the men's fault and they should get more faith and they should do this and they should do that. Well, it's true, they need to do these things too, but at the same time Allah has put in our nature certain characteristics He has put between the male and female certain attraction. And this is why in the West when you want to sell a car, the best way is you put a model in or in a bikini sitting on top of the car. Why? What does that model in the bikini have to do with the car? I mean, you want to sell a car, technically speaking, you should be telling them the engine is this size and that, it does this, it's what you... But no, what they do, they show the picture of the car, they put the picture of a woman, you know, lying on top of the car. They're telling you what, if you get this car, that's what you're going to get. Right? And everything, you look, virtually everything which is sold in the fashion. Why? Because they know the mentality of males. They've studied it. What can attract them? What is the most powerful thing that can draw them to buy this product? Connecting it with a female. This is real. So, Islam recognizing this natural attraction. An attraction which always ends up to the detriment of women. Because when they reported this 100,000 rapes, how many of them were men? not too many. The vast majority of rape cases, women being raped. So they're the ones who suffer as a result of this attraction. So Islam, recognizing the natural constitution or the natural relationship that is there, and the need for the protection of the women, has enjoined upon the women to dress in a particular fashion. Men are also enjoined to dress in a fashion which is not provocative. You know, wearing, I mean, now very common in the West now, you see the runners, they're wearing the spray-on shorts, you know, which just exposes their private parts. You know, that they use for riding the bicycles, also same thing, skin tights, this type of dress, of course. Islamically, this is also prohibited. And this is something that we should keep in mind too when we, if those of us who have televisions in our homes and they're watching wrestling, you know, wearing wrestling, these people are wearing these various costumes, exposing their private parts. I mean, even Islamically, for a man to look at that is prohibited. Prophet said that man should not look at the thigh of another man. Nor should a woman look at the thigh of another woman. So we have to be, you know, very careful in what we do, if we're not disobeying the principles of Islam in these areas of dress, whether we are male or female. Question?
What we said was, as Allah warned us, that we should fear and beware of punishment which would strike a society. Not striking only the sinful amongst them, but the society as a whole. This is a society wherein people have not striven against the evil. This is a warning. When you have an evil leadership or an evil body, and the people are just practicing their own righteousness, but they're not prohibiting that evil. This is why we talk in Islam of commanding the good and prohibiting the evil. It's essential for a Muslim. It's not only enough for him to avoid evil and do good himself, he must also, wherever he is in a position of authority or a position, you know, to speak out or to do something against the evil around him, he has to do so. So in a circumstance, as you mentioned in the last circumstance, wherein a people, there's a corrupt leadership, and there's a body of people who are striving to free themselves from that leadership, of course, that does not cover their circumstance. It's just a warning for them to keep on
not to give up. Okay? The second point that you raised is circumstance wherein a leader may not be a Muslim or not a practicing Muslim, and a female takes that leadership, that this may be a circumstance of necessity. Well, it is on a theoretical level it's possible for us to say so. But practically speaking, when you put a woman to lead you, what you're in fact saying is we cannot find a man to lead us. That's what you're saying. You're making a judgment on the society as a whole. There is no man capable in the society to lead us, so therefore we are having this woman lead us.
Okay,
let's say this, brother. When a woman reaches a position of leadership, do you think that she actually is leading? No. The military or the major forces of the society in the background, they are the ones who are leading. And the head of the military is not a woman. So she will be there as a figurehead. You know, as the male may be there as a figurehead. In those kind of societies, the woman is not going to be in a position of real power where she, as a leader now, commands. No, she will be a puppet. For Muslims to be ruled by a woman, it is a dangerous situation. The Prophet has warned us against it. So we would not choose as our leader a female. That's a general principle across the board. If you are in a non-Muslim society, you are a minority, and you have two people clamoring for leadership of that non-Muslim society. A male who is known to be a butcher of Muslims, and a female who promises some kind of reasonable dealings with Muslims. Muslims may support the election of that female to avoid, as you said, taking the lesser of the two evils. That is in a minority circumstance, which is different from where Muslims are a majority. When Muslims are a majority, then they're choosing their own leadership. In the case of a minority, they're just trying to push away some of the harm which appears to be coming towards them. So in that kind of circumstance, it's different. That is because you're not really choosing this person as your leader, per se. Because the leadership of the country is not in the hands of Muslims. You're only trying to avoid, you know, a certain amount of harm which appears to be coming to that male individual. Okay, the third question actually you raised, I wasn't clear to me.
It's a matter of family relations. A woman is more knowledgeable than a man.
In matters of family, because we talk about leadership again, where a woman may be more knowledgeable in a given area than the man, what the man should do is to listen to her advice. Not that she now takes over the leadership of the home. Right? It's two different things, right? Wherever she has knowledge in an area, it could not just be her, it could be the child also. She may have a son or a daughter who has certain knowledge of something which you have to make a decision as a whole, and he can benefit from the knowledge, he should do so. Because our general leadership in Islam is based on Shura. This is the law of command in the Quran, that you know, our affairs are judged by Shura, by consultation. That is, we do not lead in a dictatorial fashion, where it's just I say, you know, you just do, you know. No, you take advice from the people around you, whether it's in the society or in your own family. So if your wife has knowledge and so on, you benefit from her knowledge. But that thing is different from doing that and now turning over the authority to her. Now, question is, music is prohibited at all. How can music being sung by male singers, specifically Arabic songs, be shown on television? Well, as I pointed out before, the issue of what we see on television is not an issue of right and wrong. Once there are musical instruments accompanying a song, then that no musical instrument, with the exception of this hand drum called the duff, with the exception of that, these other musical instruments, wind and string, you know, violins, etc., all of these are haram. So whether it's a male singing it, or a female, or a child, or whatever, as long as it's accompanied by these kinds of background music, it becomes prohibited. Question. Does the wife have the right to question or ask about the earnings of the husband? Especially if the wife does not hold any money at all. I can only assume from this question that the wife is referring to the wife, you know, asking for some form of allowance or money to do or take care of some of her needs if she has no money. Sure, she has the right to do so. Matter of fact, Prophet, you know, when one of the female companions by the name of Hind came to him and asked what she should do in the case where her husband was very stingy, would not give her enough money for her and the child, you know, whether it's okay for her to take some of his money without him knowing. And Prophet said, take what is enough for yourself and your child. So he made that allowance for her in the case, you know, where the husband is stingy and not providing sufficiently for the family. If it's suggested it's referring to the type of earning, that is, she finds her husband coming in with all kinds of money and doesn't seem to be related to his job, you know, that he might be involved in haram, should she ask? Yes, of course. If she sees signs and things which appear to show that her husband may be involving himself in haram dealing, you know, drug distribution or, you know, something like this, he's getting money from sources which are, you know, just not conceivable, then sure, she should ask. And she should try to prohibit him, stop him from doing it if he's involved in some form of haram. If, for example, he's even working in a place which is haram, so the type of job he's doing is a haram job, she should encourage him to give up such job, you know, and find a halal means of earning a living for themselves. Because, for example, if her husband works in an alcoholic producing factory, you know, he works in a factory which produces alcohol, so this is the rest, you know, or some form of some prohibited substance or thing, you know, he works with a bank in interest, you know, he signs contracts involving interest, etc. If he is involved in any kind of work which involves something which is prohibited by Allah, then she should, it is her duty to encourage him to give up that work and to find other work. And she may have to do it from the point of view, for example, they're used to living a very comfortable lifestyle. That this job provides them with a lot of money to live very comfortable. She does so by saying that I'm prepared to live, you know, at a poverty level, virtual poverty level. It's just enough for us to eat and so, but the money you're earning is halal. I prefer that. Because obviously, he may not wanting to give up the job because of fear that it would destroy his family, they would not be able to live at this home. So she contributed to that effort by showing her willingness, expressing her willingness, you know, to live at the lower status, you know, in order for him to avoid dealing in working in a situation which is haram.